day and welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled The Seeds of War. Yes, this week we're talking about one of my favorite topics, war. Now, we have talked about war a lot on this show. I am quite interested in war. I love war movies. I don't know a lot about war, like the dates and history and things like that, but in terms of the symbolic, the metaphorical, the numinous elements of war, I do find it very interesting. And we have talked about a lot. We did a whole episode on World War II, talked about Thin Red Line, talked about different war movies as well through the lens of other topics. When we did Apocalypse Now, and we talked about the duality of man. This week, we're talking about that. We also did those 2 weeks on Russia, just depictions of Russia in cinema in light of what's going on over in the Ukraine right now. This week, we're kind of looking at the seeds of war. I was almost going to entitle this week's episode The Tree of Death, i.e. like, you know, the tree of life, and subverting that idea and talk about the tree of death, or the tree of death and destruction, i.e. war. We're really going to be focusing mostly on the seeds or the roots, or, you know, from where does, you know, the branches and the stems and the trunks of war and conflict, bullets flying, blood shed. Where does that, from what garden bed does that all sprout? And we're going to be looking at 3 pretty different films that kind of look at different aspects of war, or different, different levels of war, war at different levels. And there's quite a lot to get through. So I think we should get stuck into it right away. The first one we're going to talk about is Fernando Meirelles. Meirelles and Katia Lund's 2002 film City of God. We're then going to move on to the new film from Edward Berger, All Quiet on the Western Front from 2022. And then we're going to finish off with Barry Levinson's film from 1997, the political satire Wag the Dog. But let's kick things off now with Fernando Meirelles and Katia Lund's 2002 film City of God. So if you're not familiar with this one, it is a Brazilian film. You may have guessed that from the title. It's a pretty famous movie. I mean, it's highly ranked on like IMDb. I think this is a big movie for like film nerds, people who are just getting into film when they're like 15, 16 years old, and it's like their first foreign language film that they kind of like. It's got guns. It's kind of like the Brazilian Boys in the Hood in a lot of ways. Basically, we have a faceless narrator. His name is Rocket. And he sort of tells the story of his life so far, let's say. Not his entire life, but mainly his formative years as a young boy growing up in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. And he's got a lot of buddies as well. Specifically, there is this one kid called Lil Z, who ends up being a bit of a gang boss as the film progresses. And essentially, we're watching these young boys move up from their peasant village and rise up the ranks to become these elite gangsters in the streets of Rio. And on a pretty like basic level, I suppose you could say that this is really an exploration of sort of like what are the parents of crime? You know, that famous adage, you know, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. This is kind of like an expose on where crime, and I guess you could say revolution in a sense, but mostly, you know, crime lords, drug lords, from where do they come? So we're really looking at, to begin today's conversation, we're kind of looking at war, or let's just say conflict, I suppose, armed conflict and guns and shooting, at literally the street level. So kind of the most like basic level. We're talking about the seeds of war. So let's start off at the bottom level of the food chain here. So basically, obviously, it's a big, in talking about the parents of crime, this is a big exploration of poverty and what poverty does, and being in a place of where crime is a necessity to survive and make something of yourself. I think this is obviously a big exploration of masculinity and the thirst for prestige as well. And when that's interwoven with you know, an environment where crime is kind of like the top industry. You know, you don't really, we've got like characters in the film that's gonna go work at like grocery stores or collecting like coins on the bus, and it, just in comparison, they're so vanilla. And I think also it's interesting that this film has some interesting female characters in it too, who it sort of seems like the only way these guys can get laid as well as to be criminals, and that's kind of like just like the bare truth of societies like this, which is kind of a bit of an uncomfortable thing to come to terms with, but it is kind of true, I suppose. I mean, I never lived on the streets myself. You may not have guessed that, but I didn't. I didn't grow up on the streets. I can only know this through movies and things like that. But I think one of the key aspects, one of the key concepts that we could underline this film with is this motif of inescapability, that the world of crime is something that I had this thought a million times while watching this film. Is what other choice does a kid have growing up in a place like this too? Like, I was putting myself in these kids' shoes. I'm like, you know, it's all good, well and good to say, you know, you should pull yourself up by your own bootstraps or whatever, and if you want to make something of yourself, you know, go to school and study. But like, honestly, like, what kind of chance does a kid have trying their best? They still can't overcome it. They can't circumvent this. And that's why the character of Knockout Ned and his story, as it is in the movie, his story will be sort of spoken about a little more as we move on. But I think he's a really important character to sort of say, like, well, look, even if you are really conscientious and you do the right thing and you try your hardest to just be, you know, there's an irony there. It's like the harder you try to not be a gangster, kind of the better gangster you probably would be. Like, they talk about the idea of having, it's important to have brains, it'd be good at maths to be a good gangster, because, you know, you're good with the money and stuff like that. Or if you, you know, if you end up being, you know, quite athletic and fit, like, that also is conducive to it. So, like, it goes in kind of into like the logistics of crime a lot in a way. So, like, even if you are a good boy like Ned and you do sort of avoid it all and you work on yourself and become a good person, you know, they still even find a way to pull you in. So it's either be a complete, you know, loser that no one likes and ends up being a victim to these guys, or just a nobody, or, you know, or join in the fight kind of thing. So those are sort of the main takeaways of this film. But I think if we're going to talk about this concept of inescapability, and the fact that sort of everyone is kind of tied into this world, there's kind of this secondary theme that I think is kind of more important for the context of today's conversation. And that's the beauty of this show, is that we don't have to look at the main takeaways as the feature. Let's look at some of these background themes. The idea of things sort of, this interconnectivity of the city, everyone sort of being complicit, everyone sort of being roped in, everyone sort of being enmeshed in this mess. Now, because it's a movie, we can only sort of look at it through the lens of a finite amount of characters, and we've specifically got a narrator. But there's a huge cast, and there's so many characters, and they're all interwoven into each other's stories in a lot of different ways. And we see that in a lot of different moments in the film. At the beginning of the film, it's almost a bit confusing because you've got the protagonist. It's almost like very typical what you don't do when writing a story. Like, if you're a young boy or girl out there about to sit your NAPLAN in year three, this is not how you write a story. Don't watch City of God if you're 8 years old and you want inspiration for your NAPLAN creative writing, because essentially what they do is that they say, well, here's our protagonist. Oh, and by the way, here's his brother who's going to disappear in a few minutes. He's part of this group called the Tender Trio. And then there's like a 5 minute side plot about the Tender Trio. It's almost like a Coen Brothers thing going on a little bit. We get this like side plot about the Tender Trio, and then they all die, and then they start, and that doesn't even give away anything in the film. Like they're not even really important to the story. And then there's another bit where they talk about, you know, the history of the apartment that the big drug lord is in. And then they go through this again, this 5 minute like side story about the history. And they talk about guys that aren't even in the rest of the film. And this is another little character, Otto, who wants to avenge his father, but we don't know who his father is, and we don't know who he's trying to avenge. So we've got this interconnected web, this interconnected network. And what you could say about this film is it's kind of like 100 different stories all in one. If you look at Rio from the eagle's eye, it does sort of look like this kaleidoscopic collage of millions of different stories. And so when we're talking about this idea of interconnectivity in the crime world, are we just talking about it in a lateral sense, where everyone kind of knows each other, everyone has a million different peers, or is there a linear element to it too, right? Is there a lineage? Is there an upwards, and is there a hierarchy that goes upwards and downwards, right? And in sort of asking that question, why would we tell one story over another? How come one story might have more significance or take precedent over another story? Well, this is where we're going to bring up this theme that's going to come back in today's show, but the power of narrative, where the film is literally told through, the protagonist literally is telling his own story and talks about that. But by having him at the center, because the protagonist Rocket ends up, we actually find out he's a photographer for a newspaper. By having him at the center, it not only tells his story or our story, but it tells us a story about stories in general, about how narrative works. His camera actually becomes symbolic of a weapon. It becomes a very pivotal object in the actual story. So that the means through which stories are told actually becomes an object that changes the course of the greater story, the greater plot that's happening. So it lives up this idea of, what matters to us or where our focus is drawn is always going to be a question of someone drawing it towards something over something else, right? There is this sort of natural hierarchy of whose story is more important, not only for the people, the onlookers, but the people in the story itself, right? So in determining whose story does get told, whose story outranks someone else's story, let's move up this tree or this ladder to try and unpack sort of where that's all coming from, how those things get decided and why they get decided certain ways. But before we do that, just a reminder, you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM here on People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half hour slot. Stay tuned afterwards for more quality radio programming, or jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the show, or listening there, or sponsoring the show, or any of 2XX's wonderful programs. Moving on now, though, to All Quiet on the Western Front from last year, directed by Edward Berger. And this one pretty much, if you haven't seen this one yet, pretty much just tracks the German war effort in World War One. And if we're going to hover in this place of the lineage of war, I think this is a really good film for that. So obviously there's a lineage of people, which we've kind of already talked about, that people are interconnected with one another. And when we talk about, when we're looking at through the context of, in the context of World War One, this is where we really start seeing the chain of command. You do see that a little bit in City of God, but you really see it on a much more grand scale in the World War One, the European, well, there's only one theater but the German war effort, or any of the war efforts in World War One, but there's a clear hierarchy. They're all talking about who's a private, who's a corporal, who's a sergeant, that sort of thing. But the film itself tells all those different stories, and we sort of see the horror of the battlefield adjacent to the civility of the train carriage holding the officers who are eating croissants and drinking clinking cups of tea. We also see the warmongering of a bureaucrat in a very fancy 1918 architecture, beautifully designed room in one of these aristocratic European buildings, and we see that up against the innocence of the milkmaid who's passing by a bunch of impoverished and hungry soldiers. We're seeing all these different personalities that play out in the war right next to each other. We talked about it. Is this film? You definitely see how this film is inspired by a film like Saving Private Ryan, which probably doesn't go into much of that as well, which is probably why this one's kind of a step up. When you think about a movie like Saving Private Ryan is connected to a film like Schindler's List in a different way, obviously through Spielberg, both from the 1990s. And when you watch a movie like Schindler's List, you're also obviously reminded of Come and See, which is a film we've talked about on this show as well. And I think if you watch all four of those movies next to each other, potentially in chronological order as well, if you could figure out how to do that, that would be a really interesting... we used the word collage before. It's not quite a collage, but a chronology or a web in and of itself, but a very interesting framework or history of all the different personnel and where they all come from, different parts of the globe, and how they're all coming from different places, and they all sort of impact one another in different ways. But I definitely thought of a lot of other war movies in watching this film, but I liked how this one was comprehensive. And it had a character almost from all of them in one, in a way. It was very, sort of took all of the, it took from all the films that have come before that center on the European world wars, on the world wars, I should say, and encapsulate all of them in a way. And we do get a very strong sense of the adjacency of all these various different people with different power, different levels of power. And we sort of see that the tragedy of hierarchy or the tragedy of inequality, particularly in the context of war, where you can have someone in a clean suit drinking a cup of tea, commanding someone to go after their death, knowing that it will be immaterial, knowing that there's going to be an armistice in a matter of hours, and someone still has to go out and die and for literally for nothing. And obviously, in the context of World War One, from a modern context, I really like how this sort of abandons the idea of World War One was just a big mistake. It was just a big it shouldn't have happened. And in saying that, I think it's important to move on to the next point, which is that it's not just only a lineage of people, but there's a lineage of events. And what I mean by that is that I think this film does a really good job of reminding people what we forget about World War One, or what we frankly just don't know, and how different the world was back then, in the sense that, like, I think what we do is, this is really arrogant what we do, and we do it too much, is that we look back in history and we kind of have this lens of, it's almost like a lens of condescension, where we kind of think, they were so stupid back then. We're the stupid ones, okay? We have the internet, we don't do our own research, we don't sit around and talk. People back then weren't stupid, right? The reasons that people went to war as individuals or for various reasons, it's very complicated. And when we watch a film like this, it kind of reminds us how we could probably actually see ourselves in these people's shoes. And if we actually had the full scope of the information that they had at that time, we would have done all the same things that they did. And it's not a good thing to call people from the past stupid. They did exactly what they ought to have done from their own standing point, from where they stood. We would have done the exact same thing. We're in the same place. They talk a lot in this film about the Franco-Prussian War. No one talks about that when you learn about World War One in an Australian primary school, right? The fact that in the minds of the Germans, they'd had land taken away from them by the French, even though there had been decades of peace, right? A relatively long amount of peace between the First World War and the Franco-Prussian War, that still was irking them, right? But also on top of the fact that these people were going to war and staying in war and fighting in war, as a sheer matter of survival, right? The world at that time was not an easy and neat and tidy. It's not a neat and tidy place as it is. Can you imagine living, in the time of 1914 through the 1918, living in the trenches, living in farmland, in disputed territory, in the middle of Central Europe, or on the Western Front, I should say. It's a matter of survival, but also, and this is really, it's so clever they did this with the film, that we don't meet any English people really, or really many French people in this film. And it's important because the absence of the enemy has such an impact on your psyche in terms of going to war. Because if the enemy is faceless, or that you only understand them through whispers, through the radio, or through what people tell you, or through, dare I say, propaganda, you don't have the internet, you don't have this global interconnectedness where you can see their Facebook profile or their Instagram account. You don't know what a French person looks like if you're from Germany, if you've never met one. And you're right, they're as evil as propaganda can define for you. You can see why people would go into war knowing that there is this long lineage of conflict through Europe through this time, and it's not just a matter of people being formed by other people and having been rubbed the wrong way by an enemy, but rather the fact that your country has been through so much history, and that you actually don't have much of an interconnectedness with the enemy at all, but rather you have a connection with your country, which is really like your religious, like a religious entity to you, and that it has its own. It has its own lifespan. It has its own life cycle, and what it has been through, as not a human being, but as a political entity that you care about. So, if you want to draw some key takeaways from this film, I suppose there's a real danger in distinguishing wars, right? Because it really is just a matter of the narrative that we're told, right? Whether a war or a conflict has started or is over is really a matter of perspective, right? We could say World War One started with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, but if you were a German who's upset with what happened in the Franco-Prussian War, that hadn't ended yet. if you're a Russian today, looking back at what happened at the end of World War II, if you're looking about the way that the Russian Empire was divvied up all those years ago, those things are still resonating for you, right? There's a very good argument that the Cold War, it never ended. It was just dormant for a little while. And the Cold War really started out of the Second World War, which really started out of the First World War, which I've said started out of the Franco-Prussian War, and that didn't come out of nowhere. There's this long lineage of global events that are very much interconnected, and where we draw lines and borders to take a very noble post-structuralist approach to this, I guess you could say, is drawing these sort of arbitrary distinctions between where a conflict starts and ends gives us a false sense that there aren't still lingering ideas that could be picked up and used and exploited to reactivate or re-energize a population and throw them back into the horrors of war. So who's setting those narratives? Who's deciding to pick up these moments in history and reignite them and re-enliven them? Well, at this point, I think it's worth finishing off now with our third and final film for today, Wag the Dog, directed by Barry Levinson from 1997. And we previously discussed the power of narrative at the street level, and then we talked about All Quiet on the Western Front and the ways that individuals, you know, at all different levels may have different concepts of a narrative. And you know, we need to remember, you know, what kinds of the varying narratives we all might have at different points in history. We're going to look at now the power of narrative sort of at the top level, at the elite level. This one is a satire. It's a political satire about essentially the US president has had an affair, and they are paying this Robert De Niro, who's this like, he's like a spin expert, he's like a media spin expert, to sort of calm the waters. And he hires Dustin Hoffman, who's like a famous Hollywood producer, to basically change the narrative in the American media landscape so that the president looks pretty good. And basically what they decide to do is pretty much make up that there's a war in Albania, I think it is, to try and get people, the American public, distracted. And obviously this is a film that's a bit more about media spin and the nature of the media, and especially in 2023, this film, you know, it's almost like we kind of all know this stuff already, but I kind of want to focus on the fact that, you know, they use war as an example for a reason. We're kind of going to look at it sort of backwards a little bit and talk about, like, where does war come from in a way, even though the war is more of like the example or like the funny punchline in this film. We're kind of going to make that our focus a little bit. Now, obviously, we should say this up front, that it is a satire. And we've talked about this a lot of times on the show before, how, you know, there's a weakness to a satire, which is you can make a caricature out of a person or even out of a country, and then that the person you're trying to target just sort of flips the board and goes, oh, if you're not taking me seriously, well, why bother? But I still think they are useful, and I think this film is useful, not as a means to ridicule, but it's just a useful warning, a useful bookend to, you know, let's warn the people against what we might accidentally tumble into. This is a direction we want to avoid going into. And I want to talk about not only the power of narrative here, but the supremacy of narrative, specifically the supremacy of culture. And we've talked a lot on the show before about cultural leadership we talk a lot about, you know, in the culture, but in political discourse, we're very often talking about political power. We very often talk about economic power. I feel that we don't nearly talk enough about cultural power and the kind of the prestige and the sway and the influence that a cultural leader can have on the people and affect their economic decisions, how cultural narratives very much shape people's decisions in those other arenas. And this film is all about the supremacy of the cultural narrative over the political, over the economic. And it's why I kind of love it so much. So the sort of the best way it does this is the way that it depicts the Dustin Hoffman character, the Hollywood producer, as not only presidential, but uber presidential, like greater than presidential. So there's a couple of good quotes, but when he goes to the president, when they go to Dustin Hoffman's house in Hollywood, there's a line where they say, this is bigger than the White House. And then there's a bit where they make it very conspicuous. There's a bit where Dustin Hoffman is talking, and obviously he sort of like loves himself, and someone in the room needs to get a phone call from the president, and like a secretary walks in and goes like, the president's on the line. And then like Dustin Hoffman's like, hang on a second, I'm talking, like as if, like, you know, it's a funny joke. And then there's also another bit where he's giving a rehearsal speech in the White, he's literally in the president's chair in the White House, and as he's like leaving the room, he says to Robert De Niro, he's like, I felt at home in there. Like, that it's kind of a dark but funny joke how he keeps doing that. But there's an aspect of the film that I think is really important and kind of ties all that together really nicely, is that we never actually see the president's face, right? So that is to say, the president has no face. The president in this film has no identity. They have no agency. It's almost like they don't have control. it's almost as if the US president, and people said this a lot around the Trump and Biden elections. I remember people said, like, it almost as a means of calming themselves down, which is kind of a bit crazy in a way, but the president is kind of just like a shell. It's almost like they're just a conduit through whom the more powerful control the state. I think Bill Burr has a joke about this. He's like, the president doesn't actually earn that much money. Like, you know, the system is wrong when the president doesn't have much money. It means if they don't have much money, like, why would they be going into it? You know, like there's this implication that, like, people more powerful with more money are actually the ones that are puppeteering the whole thing. And that's all well and good. And we kind of all know that stuff already. But there's another aspect of this film, and it's kind of at the back end, which I think is really makes the film that much better, is that it definitely delves into this idea of the naivety of crowds. And ironically, they're not fueled by hate, or at least at the beginning. And the mainstream media these days will have you believe that the way that, you know, this narrative of divide and culture, conquer, and the way that politicians these days are controlling people is they're making them scared and they're making them hateful. And I'm not saying they're not doing that, but I think there's something happening first. And what I think this film does really well is it doesn't ignore, in fact, it emphasizes the power of love and compassion as empathy as a means of compelling people to think that there are very profound victims in society, which then inspires our hate against the people that threaten those victims. And so there's a character in this film that they invent called Old Shoe, and it pulls at the heartstrings of the American people, and it's from that through their compassion, through their empathy, that they want to then wage war and become hateful in order to save this poor, innocent, all-American victim. So let's tie everything together now, because we've covered a lot, right? When we started this conversation, we talked about that we do have this concept of war and destruction being the result of social and economic conditions, right? Poverty, inequality. And we realized that societies are very interconnected, that the world itself is a very large and interconnected web of narratives. So while these things can somewhat be, war can be somewhat the result of social and economic conditions, certain individuals' narratives, certain moments in history start to reign supreme as determined by, let's call it, a weaponized media, right? And while this web, you know, people are connected through this web sort of laterally and also linearly, there's also a connected web of people throughout time, or entities throughout time, political bodies throughout time, events are connected through time. So it's not just a matter of people, but a matter of history and which historical narratives reign supreme. So while it's important that we identify the powers that be and the people, you know, very often they are political figures or economic figures or whatever, what have you, who are telling us these narratives and saying, you know, this is what happened to you, this is what happened to me, this is what we need to do, this is looking at the future, this is how we need to reshape our country. We also need to understand that we as the public are complicit in all that as well, right? And it's not really just through our propensity to hate. It's not just that we need to catch ourselves when we get hateful, but also when we start to feel a sense of love and compassion and the consequences that can have in terms of, yes, we could then start to hate through love, but just knowing that we're having those reactions and knowing that it's not necessarily an act of agency. So maybe the next time we react, in any which way that might be, maybe that's by picking up the gun or jumping on to social media or something, the next time we react to a video of a bomb dropping in some foreign land or even on the house next door, maybe it's important that we take a moment just to ask whether we're about to be the ones digging up or planting the next seeds of war. Well, that's all we've got time for, unfortunately, this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX coming up, or jump onto our website to continue listening there, or jump on there to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. Well, that would be very much appreciated. But until next time, thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great week, and we'll see you again next week.